Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. 12 years ago, I ventured out to Corvallis, Oregon, to learn a thing or two about growing grass without synthetics. Mind you that I was there to research turf management for golf courses. Yes, golf courses. Not many folks in the regenerative agriculture or circular economy space can actually say that. Well, let's just say that my short venture in the world of golf showed me what not to do and who not to focus on. Well, like many things, it was, in fact, the journey that opened my eyes to a calling. And through that course in the Pacific Northwest, focused on growing healthy soil, I set a new course to get off the golf course. That's terrible, but we're going to go with it. So I geared out and ready to learn how I could save the world by making cleaner golf courses, I guess. Well, while this training class focused on soil health, I began to learn the truths about food and how it's produced. And that interest has since evolved into my passion. And now, a dozen years later, it's a purpose. Coming at it from diverse backgrounds, my classmates in that course on soil health taught me a great deal. But it was the professor, the curator, the initiator of this soil food web that forever changed the course of my life. And now, for our 50th episode of Sourcing Matters, the final episode of our first season, we welcome that teacher and mentor as our guest. Today, we welcome a legend in our field, Dr. Elaine Ingham. Hi, Elaine. How you doing?
Okay, great. Aaron, thanks for the great buildup. Woohoo! I'm honored.
Hey, of course. Well, it's all true. You've meant a great deal to me. And as I would probably come back, maybe bring us back to earth in this and say, I don't know if I should kiss your ring and thank you for helping me find my calling or curse you for casting this affliction on me.
Well, you know, we'll all figure that out when we're on the other side.
I think so. Well, I think I know actually what side I'm on, and I would thank you. So let me do this, and let me read a little bit about your background, what you're up to, and then I'll jump in with the questions.
Okay.
Okay, so Elaine Ingham maintains an active schedule of classes and webinars focused on the most up-to-date knowledge about growing plants without pesticides and or inorganic fertilizers. Additionally, Ingham consults and educates large-scale commercial cotton and soybean growers, large-scale berry growers, as well as large commercial fruit producers, and even shrimp producers. Furthermore, you are in the process of starting a new company with several top names in the field of biological agriculture. I look forward to hearing more about that. So, Elaine, maybe you could tell us a little bit, or tell us and our audience a little more about your impressive background and what you're up to now.
Well, I've been doing, trying to understand life in the soil, who are the organisms that benefit plants at different stages of succession, and have come to realize that it is the biology in the soil that drives succession. So if you want to keep moving forward through more and more and more productive ecosystems, well, then you have to understand the ratio of fungi to bacteria in that soil. You have to understand the things that eat and thus eat the bacteria and fungi and thus release nutrients in a plant-available form. So this understanding of what's really driving nature. Now, when we're trying to grow a particular plant, we want to make certain that we understand what the successional balances for this or for the organisms in the soil needs to be to make that plant the most productive that you can make it. And what we've been seeing over the last 4 years, we've had replicated scientific trials where we've been comparing dirt, and so everything that we were starting with was dirt, and then added the biology to half the field and not to the other half of the field, and then was able to compare the yields. And in the first growing season, we see a 50% increase in yield, typically. In the second year, we see an increase of 300%, typically. And in the third year, we see an increase of 1,000%. So when we talk to those when we listen to the Monsantos or the chemical companies of the world, and you can't grow plants without the inorganic fertilizers and all our toxic chemicals. We have to expand the amount of land that we're cultivating in order to feed the world. That's absolutely not true.
Hmm.
We can feed the people on less than the agricultural land that we've got in cultivation right now. We have to understand how to work with nature instead of against. So that's kind of what I've been doing my whole life, and that's 45 years that I've been working on this. And, probably the shocker for some people is going to be, we don't know everything about it yet. So got to keep working, have to keep making these advances. Is 1,000% increase in yield as compared to the toxic chemical system, is that the max? We don't know, because every year where we've managed to maintain the biology, keep it in the right balances, the plants have grown, have given us much greater harvest, much greater production in yields. So is it 1,000% increase over the chemical system? Have we reached the top? Probably not.
Hmm.
So we've only begun.
Only scratched the surface here. And I think that's key, the power of soil. I remember learning in your course a dozen years ago that there are more microbes in a tablespoon of soil than there are people on the planet.
Exactly.
So on your site, soilfoodweb.com, you state that you and your team can restore soil at its optimum state and at any scale, that you grow plants without disturbance, pesticides, and inorganic fertilizers, as I mentioned. Now, you'll also say that this is kind of an important part that many without this know-how maybe get, is that you also work on building these self-sustaining ecosystems, the communities, the living environments that harmonize effectively as societies, that these microbes that are teeming in healthy soil underfoot. So based off of your decades of pioneering work as a soil microbiologist, you authored the USDA Soil Primer based off a concept you coined called the Soil Food Web. Can you explain to our audience what the Soil Food Web is?
The Soil Food Web is all of those organisms that have to be present in soil. If we're really going to be growing plants in a sustainable fashion, we need to have certain numbers, certain types, species of all of these different groups present in your soil in order to maintain that balance, that ecological stability, where year after year after year, you can basically do very little other than plant your seeds and go back and harvest. And really, that's what farming should be all about, not, you know, every week or three times a week out there putting on some additional toxic chemical. Even in the organic world, we are allowed to use salts that kill a lot of these organisms in the soil. If you're putting lime or gypsum out, allowed in organic regulations, but you're killing the biology that are the very basis for exiting the weeds from your system, from exiting the diseases in the pests. So, you know, people just don't understand that you have to have all of the food web. You have to have, well, you got to have a plant in the system first. Which plant are you trying to grow? So now what's the balance of bacterial and fungal biomass present in that soil? You don't want any of the diseases. How do you get rid of all the disease-causing organisms? Well, that's the habitat that's built by those bacteria making the microaggregates, the fungi making that macroaggregates, and building the houses for these organisms to live in the soil, which also allows oxygen and water and the roots of your plant to go as deep down into the soil as they possibly can. And when we look at, you know, most of our row crops, certainly our vegetables as well, our root system should not be forced to go sideways at 2 to 4 inches or 6 inches down where your, you know, where your tillage equipment has imposed a compaction layer. Those root systems should be going down 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 feet into the soil. And if you've got your soil in a condition by getting the bacteria and the fungi, the protozoa, the nematodes, the microarthropods, the earthworms, the spiders, and all of those other beneficial organisms, get those back into your soil, and you will build that structure, and they will maintain that structure using the exudates coming from the root system of the plant. So So we just have to get these sets of organisms back into the soil and the proper balances for the plant you want to grow. And then you as a farmer have very little that you have to do. So the biggest expense for growers is to convert their dirt, which we have, with the best of intentions, we hope, destroyed all of this life in the soil, and now you're trying to farm on dirt. Well, you're not going to be successful. So we've got to get this biology back into the soil, be sustainable, get the carbon back into the soil from whence we've blown it all off into the atmosphere, and get this nutrient cycling system, this building soil structure system, caring for your plant, preventing diseases and pests and weeds, and no need to be putting any additional chemicals back into the system. Nature already has that covered. And most people have been just oblivious, especially soils people, oblivious to the fact that every second of every day, nature is replenishing the mineral nutrients in your soil. So until the day that you run out of rocks, boulders, parent material, you do not need to be adding inorganic fertilizers. You just have to get the biology back into the soil that will convert the not plant available form of those nutrients that are in the sand, silt, clay, rocks, and pebbles. Any of you missing sand, silt, clay, rocks, or pebbles? No? So got to get the biology back to do this work. Nature has been performing in this way for the last billion years. As soon as rooted plants came into existence on this planet, this nutrient cycling system was already in place. So why are we destroying it? Well, okay, maybe it's because somebody wants to be making a lot of money on the backs of the people who are trying to grow those plants. Wake up, farmers. You shouldn't have to be working this hard. Most of your money should stay in your pocket.
It's interesting, and it's very graceful, Elaine, the way you described that. It's like you've done that before a few times, maybe. I don't know.
Had a little practice.
A little bit of practice there, yeah. One thing that has come to light, I think, as people start to look at even where they're interacting maybe with soil, which is the externalities associated to their food choices. And that can be, as you mentioned, carbon issues that can deal with a worldwide water crisis. What does this good soil do for banking carbon or for managing water?
Well, you need to have a way to clean up all the toxic chemicals that might be in the water. Well, A, if you don't put the toxic chemicals into your soil, then there's a huge reduction in the problem right there. But all of those inorganic fertilizers, those toxic chemicals that they're using, applying, spraying, spreading out on fields, they're leachable because they are water-soluble. For your plant to be able to take something up, it has to be water-soluble. If you put on 450 pounds per acre of nitrate fertilizer or urea or whatever form of inorganic, soluble, leachable nitrogen, we know from studies that were done back early in the 1990s, we know that 80% of that is going to be lost. The more inorganic fertilizers, the more toxic chemicals you put out, the more you're going to be losing, because only 20% is actually going to be captured by your plant and pulled into the plant. The kind of visual I like to give to people to think about is, this is kind of like when you order pizza. You pick up the phone, you put an order in, and then, you know, the Pizza Hut puts the pizza together and then sends the delivery guy out and brings the pizza to your home. And when we're looking at nutrient uptake by plants, really what your plant is doing is putting out exudates. Well, that's the phone call. Go into the pizza restaurant to make the pizza. And so the exudate goes out. The bacteria and fungi they're the guys at the counter in Pizza Hut, and they make the pizza for you. So specifically what the bacteria and fungi do are to make the enzymes that pull the nutrients out of the sand, silts, clays, wax, pebbles, etc. There's your pizza. It's been made. It's waiting for you. Where's the pizza delivery guy? It's the protozoa, the nematodes, the microarthropods, the earthworms that eat the bacteria and fungi, thereby release those nutrients right at the surface of the plant. The plant doesn't have to expend any energy setting up a diffusion gradient to pull those nutrients into the root system. It's delivered right to their door. Precisely what kind of pizza do you want? I want a Hawaiian with double cheese. It's delivered to the doorway, to the root system, to the door of the house, and the plant takes it up with no expenditure of energy to be taking those things up. So, you know, we have to understand that that's how this works. And if this nutrient cycling is happening that rapidly, every second of every day, your plant is being delivered right to the door, the mix of all the nutrients it needs in the proper balances. So your plant's getting everything it needs. It's never stressed. And if that plant is getting all the nutrients it needs, it's putting all the nutrients that should be appropriate in the seeds or into the fruit, whatever part of that plant we're going to eat, is now has the highest concentration of nutrients that you can possibly get from that plant. So from a human food point of view, we have to go back to using the system that nature has developed over the last billion years. She kind of figured things out. Us human beings, we've only been doing this for the last, 70 to maybe 100 years. Do we know what we're doing? Obviously, we don't have a clue. And so now we're just barely starting to have a clue. We've recognized that the toxic chemicals that we've poured on our soil and turned it into dirt has resulted in the leaching of most of these nutrients into our water, into our surface and groundwaters. And maybe most people don't connect that with the water coming out of your tap. The water coming from the water treatment plant, they have to spend lots more money now on trying to clean all the toxics out of the water, and they're not successful. The water coming out of our tap is not the quality that we used to have back in the 50s, back in the 40s, back in the early parts of the 1900s. So we're all trying to deal with water that's been toxified because we've got to put chemicals into it to prevent all these nasty things from either being in the water or growing in the water on the way to your house. When you're drinking water that has a high chlorine content in it, what's it doing to the microorganisms in your digestive system? So no wonder you've got ulcers. No wonder you have severe constipation followed by severe diarrhea and then back again. And it's just, how do you ever even things out? Well, you need to start paying attention to the quality of the nutrients in your food and to the water that you're drinking.
So we're strip mining our system for the shortcuts of many of our agricultural models. And as you mentioned, the salts associated to that on the fertilizer side, but we also have the persistent pesticides, the fungicides, all of this creating, maybe being expedited through our water table.
Yeah.
And we, as you said, are now seeing, probably more through empirical evidence, but the impact that these shortcomings are having. Elaine, let me ask this, because I think it's a key point. Many people have become interested or more interested in soil health, appreciative that there's key, that soil may be underfoot, the kind of a savior for us all. But many still are reliant on chemistry tests instead of biological tests. I remember you explaining that the chemistry comes from the biology. Have you seen growers or managers of natural resources start to be more adoptive of the idea that it really comes down to the biology first and the chemistry as a result?
Yeah, we are demonstrating that that's the case in lots and lots of land all over the world. You have to realize that in the United States, this is pesticide central. This is toxic agricultural chemical central. Because this is where all those toxic chemical companies are headquartered, typically someplace in the U.S. Well, Europe has a few of their own, but we're living in the center of it. And so, of course, they've got the most sway. Well, they make, you look at Monsanto, and it has a profit margin that it makes every quarter, $5 billion in profit. And my numbers are a little old and out of date, more now, but they've got clout in our social system because we put so much emphasis on how much money do you make as being an indicator of a person's goodness or successfulness, whereas really we need to switch that around to something else rather than just relying on your ability to gouge your neighbor for money. We've got to get over that. We have to get back to putting the emphasis in the right place, making nutrient-rich food, and making sure our water is cleaned up, and make sure that when we have fires that leave denuded soil, for example, the very first thing that we need to do is go out and apply a good set of microorganisms that will overnight tie up that soil, rebuild structure, and prevent those surfaces from slip sliding down the slope and having mudslides like that we have seen over the last couple of years in California. And we are just so primed right now to have that repeat in a really horrific way this year.
Let's talk about how this comes to fruition. So obviously many of us have a problem in the agricultural models that we've selected, but we know we have a problem. We're going to run some tests to discover, we got some bad biology in our soil. How do we start to remediate this and to rapidly increase soil health and vitality? I think the most common place, we've had a lot of discussions on our show around using animals back on land as a mechanism to engage them back in the trophic food web. But I think what our audience would love to hear more about is your work with compost, and especially compost tea. Maybe you could explain what compost tea is and why this could be a pretty revolutionary delivery mechanism.
What we do is make certain that the really beneficial species of the food web, the bacteria, the fungi, the protozoa, the nematodes, are present in your compost. It's pretty easy to make compost if you've got the recipe right. And we help people figure out what that recipe is for their local starting materials. And you want local materials with the local microorganisms on them. We've got a lot of the chemical companies are starting to sell their special little batches of, we've got 16 billion Pseudomonas fluorescens in our culture, it's the best, you're going to see the most growth. No, you're not. That's one species of bacterium that you're putting in. And where was that bacterium isolated from? From Pennsylvania? From Brazil? From Asia? Where is it coming from? So what's the environmental conditions? What are the weather conditions that particular species, subspecies of that particular species of bacteria, where is it going to grow? And 99.999999% of the Earth's surface is probably not appropriate for that microorganism to grow. And yet these big companies are trying to tout that this is going to give you some benefit. Probably not, because it's not going to grow in your conditions, under your weather patterns, in your soil, with all of the background that's happened with your soil over the years. So we really want to make certain that we're helping people grow the best set of microorganisms for your climate, for the place you are. So we get people making really good compost. You don't have to make a lot. We'll put together 500 pounds of compost, the starting materials, the right balances, getting the right microorganisms growing in that pile. 500 pounds, that's all you need to make. If you need more compost than that, we'll put inocula of that pile. That 500 piles will make an extract where we're going to actually pull out of that solid form of the compost all those huge, massive numbers of these beneficial organisms that you've grown under your weather conditions using your plant material. We'll extract them using water, and then we'll put that into the compost. And now as they grow in that compost, we will put that out onto the soil. We can also extract those microorganisms from that really good compost. And after we've extracted those organisms from that compost, now we can add food resources that will grow those microorganisms in a liquid tank. So over the next 24 hours, we will increase the bacteria by tenfold, we'll increase the fungi by fivefold, we'll increase the protozoa by threefold, and the nematodes don't grow that fast. So they've got to be growing out in your soil, but hopefully your compost contained really good levels of beneficial nematodes, and we'll be able to apply those out on your soil around your trees. You know, are you going to inject that into the soil? Are you going to slightly harrow that into the soil? Are you going to put it on the surface and then cover that surface with a really good mulch that you've inoculated? So there's lots of different kinds of practices, and a lot of the training that we do is helping people figure out what's going to be the most effective way for them to get these organisms into the soil, because once you've gotten them into your soil, you don't have to keep re-inoculating them unless you do something silly, like killing those organisms with an inorganic fertilizer, or killing with an herbicide, or killing them with a pesticide. So as long as you maintain that biology, it's going to be there for as long as you're growing plants in that system. So when you had asked me in the previous question, and I've forgotten to answer, you asked me whether, you know, what about soil chemistry tests as compared to soil biology tests. The only time I find a soil chemistry test useful is right at the very beginning. What horrors are left in your soil that nobody told you about? You know, 60 years ago, they applied DDT. Did anyone tell you about that? Did anyone inform you that you've got a layer of DDT-saturated soil down at 4 feet? Did you know that? And how are you going to deal with that? Why hasn't that DDT been decomposed and disappeared? Because we've been killing all these organisms in the soil long before you ever put any DDT out. And so how do you get rid of that DDT? Well, there's a really good mix of microorganisms, but what's critical here is when we say mix, because we don't know what the weather is going to be like this summer. We don't know what's going on down there at 4 feet. So we're going to inject into your soil these really good sets of organisms, all your regular everyday ones from your compost that you've made yourself. And then we're going to put in more species that are particularly good at decomposing DDT. There's a number of companies around the world that are starting to really research and grow these very special organisms that you utilize under these very specific conditions, and you're going to be adding specific amounts of food resources, and you've got to get the right food resources for the right microorganism to decompose that DDT. What else might be left in your soil? Well, do you have some dicamba? Do you have some Roundup? I mean, I love the fact that we've just people have shown and proven in court that Roundup causes cancer. So we've got a lot of work to do to get rid of those Roundup residues, because if you don't have good biology in your soil, you can't decompose glyphosate. It's going to stick around forever. How do you get the right biology and the right foods to decompose these toxic chemicals that are probably in your soil at this time? I don't know any place on this planet that hasn't most likely been impacted by glyphosate as drift. When you think about the massive amount of Roundup that's been applied all over, of course it's drifting. Of course it's getting into our ecosystems. In California, in one of the farms I was working on, we went out to their old growth area because we thought it would be a place where we could get really good inoculum of these microorganisms. And as I'm walking through that old growth forest, I'm going, these are not healthy trees. These trees are showing symptoms of all kinds of diseases. Well, how can that be? Because these trees have been here growing for the last 1,500 years. Well, something's causing their immune system. Something has wiped out the good guy biology in here, and all these trees are dying. And we would dig down into the soil, and we would bring some of that soil back with us to the lab and look at it, and there are no beneficial fungi left in that soil. So if we would like to still have old-growth forests, we're going to have to go back in and inoculate them, and we're going to have to get rid of the toxic chemicals that are causing those kinds of problems.
We have been bad managers. Maybe we just didn't know the impact of this extensive use that we've had. And to your point, I've read that we found glyphosate, trace elements of glyphosate in the Antarctic and the Arctic at this point and everywhere in between. So the most used chemical in the world, I believe, at this point. It is scary because it is on everything and they're finding new uses for it as not just a genetic engineering tool, but a preservative tool. So we have a great distance to go. And actually, I want to continue this conversation about some of the work that you've done on educating a consumer base. So not many folks, I think, know this, but in 1990, or in the early 90s, you effectively saved all plant matter and all living matter, including us, from extinction. Let me read this, if I could. In 1992, the Environmental Protection Agency was only a few weeks away from ending life on the planet as we know it, so writes George Lawton in April 2001 issue of Acres magazine. Lawton reports that the EPA, although having done limited tests at the time on a variety of genetically engineered microbes, all of which have been approved for release into the atmosphere, were prepared to approve a genetic engineered variant called Klebsiella planticola.
Klebsiella planticola.
Thank you very much. I'll rely on you for that.
Yep.
One of the most common bacteria on the planet. This particular variety of GEKP, we'll call it in this case, he writes, had a unique ability to convert dead plant matter into alcohol. It was hoped that it would provide a way for farmers to transform their unused stalks, their leaves, their other types of compost material into alcohol, which could be used for washing or running vehicles, not returning back to the nutrient cycling program that you had mentioned, but a quick way of getting raw energy out of this. So maybe you could explain to our audience what went wrong and tell us what happened behind the curtain.
Yeah, because this was touted as a way to stop field burning. So instead of leaving your residues after harvest on the surface of the soil where it promotes, because you don't have good biology left in your dirt, it promotes the growth of the pathogens and the pests and the diseases and things like that. So instead, the idea was to rake up all that material, put it into a giant bucket on the farm, and then inoculate all of that material with the Klebsiella planticola engineered to produce alcohol, which is something that the parent does not do. So the idea then was to seal that tank up because alcohol production only occurs under anaerobic conditions, and that's what the addition of enzymes to the Klebsiella planticola did, was gave it the enzymes to be able to produce alcohol. The idea was that after about 2 weeks, you would open the spigot at the bottom of the bucket, and you would be getting a liquid that would be about 34 proof, which is kind of just it's vodka, but made from, who knows, grass material, from corn stalks, from whatever. And so then, you know, great, we're going to make a profit for the grower by producing this high alcohol content material, liquid, that could be sold and used for, you know, endless number of uses. The residue left on the bottom of the bucket, they realized, would be very high in nitrogen because alcohol contains no nitrogen. The liquid that would be decanted off would not have that nitrogen. So all of the nitrogen from the plant material is now concentrated. A lot of the carbon's gone off in the alcohol. So high nitrogen, high phosphorus, high sulfur, high magnesium. This is the perfect fertilizer. So the idea was that they would take that fertilizer, that sludge on the bottom of the bucket, spread it out on your fields as a form of fertilizer. And that's what we were asked to look into. What's the effect of having this genetically engineered microorganism to produce the alcohol? What effect would it have on the soil? And my graduate students committee looked at the experiments that my graduate student put together. You know, pretty simple. You're going to put out the parent Klebsiella planticola in the same concentrations as the genetically engineered Klebsiella planticola, and then you would have a control where you didn't add any additional organisms into the system. And they looked at his research and they said, this is great because we will finally show that, you know, there's no effect of genetically engineered organisms on the growth of plants. So he did his experiment. The Klebsiella plant, the plants, the wheat plants that just had water, no additional microorganisms, grew 2 or 3 inches in the first week, where the parent, not genetically engineered organism, was put into the system. The plant was growing 10 to 12 inches tall. So what does Klebsiella planticola do for your plant? Yeah, it helps weed out a lot. But where the genetically engineered material had been put into the Klebsiella planticola, all of the plants were dead. So you look at that kind of experiment, and it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to go, I think there's something terribly wrong with this genetically engineered organism, because the normal bacterium benefits plant growth. This kills it, and it's because of the alcohol production right around the root system of that plant, less than one part per million alcohol. And, you know, please realize that there are hundreds of thousands of different kinds of alcohols, and the Klebsiella planticola was engineered to produce alcohol from any kind of organic compound, so that there were probably, you know, lots of different types of alcohols being produced, and it would kill any terrestrial plant. So think of what would happen to human beings if all terrestrial plants were killed because we released this genetically engineered organism. And the plan was, about a, 2 weeks after my graduate student noticed the effects and went to the head of the EPA here in Corvallis and said, here's our results, and this is frightening. Because if we do this field trial, this field release, to try to determine how far downwind does a genetically engineered organism go, if you're spraying it into the air, how far will it go? And we release it, and this is going to be the effect on all the ecosystems in Oregon. How rapidly does a genetically engineered organism, or any organism, move out from a single point inoculation? And we know from other work that the EPA did but won't admit that they've done this. They know that a genetically engineered organism certainly has the ability to move 11 miles from that point inoculum every year outward. And so by the time you're at, 15 years down along in time, every place on the planet shows that genetically engineered organism present in the system. So from that date, we would have had 15 years before every single terrestrial plant was destroyed. And how would that affect your life? We could all, be trying to get our hands on those few plants that human beings can produce in aquatic systems. So all of us would eat rice for the rest of our lives, but where are you going to produce enough rice to feed the world? You want some chaos? And so that's where people say life on this planet would end. Life as we know it on this planet would end. Well, life wouldn't really end. The bacteria, the fungi, protozoa, nematodes, all those critters in the soil are going to be perfectly happy, growing in those few places where there's organic matter left. And there would still be moss and there would still be algae, but certainly I don't think we would have human beings pretty rapidly. We humans would not be able to survive.
Even an impetus of the next mass extinction.
Yeah. And every once in a while you look at what we're doing to this planet, and I think Mother Nature is finally going to have enough of us screwing around, not paying any attention to the consequences of what we're doing. Yeah, so it's not a real happy kind of view. And so my hope is we can get people to understand that they need to be putting this biology back into their soil, getting back in harmony with nature instead of fighting Mother Nature. In a war between Mother Nature and human beings, who's going to win that war? We might have won a couple battles here using toxic chemicals, but we're losing the war, and we're starting to lose it really badly. How do we turn things around? We have to be putting the biology back into the soil.
So are we going to learn that as a species before it's too late? Or are we learning that as a species?
Certainly in the last 5 years, the increased amount of interest in what is soil really. Soil has to include organic matter and soil organisms. It is the soil organisms that do all the work for your plant to be able to be healthy and happy and not stressed and produce the maximum benefit food, the highest nutrition, requires this biology working, because we as human beings are not capable of asking each little root hair, what is the nutrient it needs to be taking up right now? We can't do that. There is no monetary system that could support that kind of knowledge about every single root hair on every single plant in every single agricultural field on the planet. So nature has already figured out a way to do this. Let's learn how that system works, and let's start mimicking what nature has been doing for the last billion years on this planet. Why are human beings so arrogant? Poor little Mother Nature, she doesn't know what she's doing. Oh, yes, she does. Just because it doesn't make you money doesn't mean nature doesn't know what she's doing.
Mm. It's interesting to look at it also from a couple of different lenses. I know you do a lot of international work. You do work in Australia and in some of the stressed areas that climate change has happened. It's a new climate that they're basically living within, and expressing to people that are landowners or managers at that time that things need to change and they need to invest is probably a much stronger call to action. Stateside, we've been a bit of a spoiled brat. We've got this bounty of natural resources. To your point, we've been really we have been the synthetics capital, because we have both the companies but also the resources to propagate this. Are you seeing hope stateside? Are we going to be able to use our innovation and innovative spirit to rejigger this, to look at it and be more biomimetic in our approach?
It's starting to happen. And a lot of it is that we've been working at a grassroots level trying to get the general public to understand that they've been hoodwinked by these big chemical companies. They've been told the only way to grow plants on a large scale is to use these inorganic fertilizers. Well, that's absolute nonsense. We can make all these beneficial organisms. We can, you know, make really good compost, really good extracts and teas, and get this biology into the soil where it sustains itself. All you have to have are plants in the system. And gosh, agricultural systems, do we have plants in the system? Of course we do. So you just have to promote that right set of balances of the organisms into the support your plant. Yeah, so it started, it's beginning. You're going to have to look out for those chemical companies that are trying to, you know, put out that they know this biological agricultural approach, and they sell these jugs of bugs where there's only one or four, or I think the maximum I've seen is 12 microorganisms. They're all bacteria. They're all anaerobic. They are not going to be benefiting your plants, so please look out for the con artists who are out there in force. You need the whole food web. You need the bacteria and the fungi and the protozoa and the nematodes. And as soon as you get those good guys in your soil, you're going to have earthworms, and you're going to have the microarthropods, and you're going to have all of the rest of the system moves back in and starts doing your work for you. On a 300-acre farm, we reduce costs for those growers in the first year by $200,000. And each year afterwards, they continue to save more money. So if you want to actually get back to a place where you as a farmer, you as the grower, is keeping the money in your pocket instead of sending it off to the chemical companies to do horrible things like, try to pretend that the Russians didn't, let's not go into politics.
We'll save that for the next conversation.
Right.
Fantastic, Elaine. Thank you so much. Where can our listening audience learn more about your classes, your webinars, your new papers that you're putting out? Is soilfoodweb.com the best location?
Right now, yes, soilfoodweb.com is the best place to go, but we're starting a new business, so we're really going to be getting into the educational marketing sort of thing, and that is Soil Food Web Institute. So, you know, typically if you go to my website, soilfoodweb.com, my company, anytime you click on any of the buttons, once the new website gets up, so after the 15th of January would be the, you know, if you want to go see the whole show, anything you click on my website will take you to the new website, and then you can get that information on what the website address is. I think it'll be soilfoodwebinstitute.com.
Okay. I can put links on the write-up as well, both in our iTunes account and on the webpage, but that's wonderful information, and I'll just remind our listening audience to look out for these snake oil salesmen, and whether you're a producer managing natural resources or you're have the opportunity to vote with your fork and, you know, have better food selections and regenerative or resilient agricultural models, it's time to invest in being part of the soil food web and to these circular economies. So, Elaine, I have to thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work. And thank you so much for the inspiration you've given me. Again, I greatly appreciate all the effort that you've put in.
Well, I certainly appreciate all the work that you do getting the information out to folks. And we've got to work together on these things as teams. And so thank you for inviting me to talk.
Fantastic. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Thanks.
Happy Turkey Day. Gobble, gobble.